This is tape number 11 of Goblinhood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblinhood. This tape commences actually in the middle of it's in part two, it's in the middle of a newspaper story written by Goblinhood for the local newspaper. It was all pretty confusing, so I soon found my attention wandering to the movie that was on television. The film's plot gradually became clear. Unethical defense contractors were building unsafe space vehicles with shoddy, substandard parts and endangering lives. At the end, during the launch, the rocket got safely, successfully away, but the gantry, instead of doing whatever it was supposed to do, literally fell apart, hurling frantic ground crew personnel to a falling, fiery demise. This was all pretty confusing too, to me, anyway. But as the cops moved in to bust the crooks responsible, the credits flashed across the screen. The movie was called Fools Die. Hey, I know that title. I babbled to St. Hawk and Samothrace. I think it's a book by Mario Puzo, who wrote The Godfather. Geez, I never knew that it was about this stuff. I'll have to read it now. St. Hawk commented that she had heard of it too, and added that the author had won some kind of award for his books. Soon a commercial or something came on the screen and I lost interest. St. Hawk and Samothrace were talking about the festival again, and I still couldn't figure out whose honor it had been held in. But a strange thing started happening just then. Though everyone was fully clothed, we were all lying half under this huge blanket which covered the mattress. Now, as these two women talked, one of them, Samothrace, I believe, began to stroke my hand under the blanket with her toes in a distinctive, repetitious pattern. It didn't seem sensual, but seemed to convey some urgency. It reminded me a little of Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s Bakanonist ritual from the novel Cat's Cradle, but it also seemed more pointed. I became extremely sensitive to this weird routine, realizing that it was a message of some importance being delivered in a tactile form of Morse code. Concentrating hard, I finally deciphered the message, a communique from the entire sisterhood union. They were saying, "Don't be afraid of us. We are your friends." This message was repeated over and over, like a radio message being beamed to or from outer space. While this was still going on, Samothrace asked me, in normal verbal mode, if I would go out to the store and get her and St. Hawk a pack of cigarettes. I guess that's what clued me that I was dreaming, because these two didn't smoke. Realizing that I only had 10 minutes or so to wake up if I wanted to remember this dream and to record the message intact, as opposed to the sort of garbled version I have of the earlier segment of the dream, I got out of the huge bed and left the room, heading not for the store, but for the world of waking reality. My journey back to full consciousness was not unlike negotiating a long series of dimly lit hallways, each of which had slightly better lighting, until I finally reached a very bright chamber called the opening of the eyes. And so I left them there, probably forever, in order to bring me their urgent message. Don't be afraid of us. We are your friends. And it sometimes seems to me that the whole world is constantly saying that to me for various nefarious purposes. But only in a case like this am I willing to listen uncritically, no matter what they have in mind. My family, right or wrong. I only wish that I could find my way back there. And I can't help wondering who the festival was for. A brief postscript to this dream tale of goblin hoods might be of interest regarding the mention of the biblical character of Joseph. Not God's dad, but some much earlier poor Joe, the one with the colorful coat, in fact, whose sartorial splendor had many years previous to this originally helped inspire the gob's still Christianoid creator to experiment with hand-painted costumery. Weird, huh? In the Bible, in chapter 27 of Genesis, Joseph basically got sold into slavery for having grandiose dreams and smarting off about them to his siblings. Ironically, in passing, the very next chapter, on the same page in fact, features the death of Onan, killed by Yahweh for spilling his seed on the ground, who might just as well have been Goblinhood's patron saint. Back to Joseph. He later became the subject of what has been called by science fiction editorial great Anthony Boucher, the first alternate world story written. This according to all-round great Isaac Asimov. The story was hands-off by Edward Everett Hale, grandnephew of the American Revolution's great patriot and martyr, Nathan Hale. E.E. Hale is best known as the author of The Man Without a Country. Hands Off, published in 1881, speculates about what history might have been like if Joseph had escaped being sold into bondage. The story's John Barr hinge is the life or death of a little yellow dog. Of some interest, but possibly only to idiots, is the fact that Yellow Dog became, a few millennia later, the title of one of the longest-running underground comics series in the Gob's home con. But after all, as Hale points out in his story, the evil that dogs do lives after them. Hale's story also mentions, very briefly, a Sidonian admiral, just as Goblinhood's earlier career had involved a Sidonian Sphinx. Hale's yarn, almost Einsteinian in scope, was a study in the interconnectedness of all things, though the author used it mainly as an explanation of some of the weirder features of Yahweh's wonderful plan for all the folks who were supposed to have free will. To this end, though, Hale also became a great pioneer in the field of harmlessness technology, because none of the carnage resulting from the change counted. The world mangled by Joseph's altered status was more or less imaginary or populated with a species of humanoid lab rats for angels to experiment and play with. To demonstrate how fucked up things could get if anybody deviated from Yahweh's wonderful plan. But an even more interesting gloss on that transitional phase of the Gob's dream exists, Joshua himself was mentioned, both by name and by analogy, in a story entitled The Man Who Could Work Miracles by H.G. Wells, published in 1898. Both of these tales, by the way, can be found in a book entitled Isaac Asimov Presents The Best Fantasy of the 19th Century, Beaufort Books, Inc., 1982. This Wells story might be regarded as the first fantasy tale to deal significantly with psionic powers, but this assessment overlooks the Vrilya people of Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton's 1871 novel The Coming Race, a book which is said to have heavily influenced and helped to derange Adolf Hitler. The Man Who Could Work Miracles, by contrast, was highly influential circa early 1988 in the development of Goblin Hood's psionic Martian harmlessness sigil. Wells, of course, was also the architect of the first literary Martian invasion, also published in 1898, and by a provocative coincidence happened to share the same birthday with Goblin Hood's creator. Speaking of strange influences, according to hearsay, probably an astrology book about Virgos, that same birthday of September 21st, a red-letter day in Sodom, rest assured, was also supposed to be shared by the Canadian poet Leonard Cohen, whose brilliant 1966 novel, The Beautiful Losers, first inspired Goblin Hood to go around kissing women's assholes. Strange, if true, but as any member of this presumptive September triumvirate would probably agree, truth is, after all, stranger than fiction. Anyway, unlike G.H., the protagonist of H.G.'s yarn works his miracles in front of people who watch in what Wells calls, in one case, a sort of ejaculatory silence. This clown tries to pull a Joshua and screws everything up so badly that a great disgust of miracles came upon him. But these literary interpretations of that one small part of Goblin Hood's dream exist very much after the fact. When writing Family Matters, Goblin Hood was simply reporting his dream verbatim, for whatever it was worth to anybody, acting as a pseudo-psycho-pompous messenger from the land of sleep, whose gardener or landscape architect is the subconscious, perhaps the collective subconscious, for all anyone truly knows. Goblin Hood's dreaming mind was acting as a kind of nocturnal goat sucker, and the dream and its record acted as the nocturnal goat sucker's cry. At which point, these chance or subconscious resemblances to seminal tales of alternate history and psionic woe can either be shrugged off as sheer coincidence or embraced and accepted as minor wonders in an atmosphere of ejaculatory silence. In this context, however, it's particularly interesting that the gob never read Hale's story, which mentions, by the way, a general ejaculation by people upon discovering the yellow dog's fate, until after he'd recorded his dream, and then he read it only by chance while browsing in his library, trying to find out the real lowdown on Joshua. One final odd coincidence, or Jungian synchronicity is this fact. As it happens, Nathan Hale, ancestor of Edward Everett Sloan, was apprehended by the British for spying on the birthday of H.G. Wells and the Gob's creator in 1776, roughly about two centuries before the 1976 Viking spacecraft would make its mad dash out yonder to discover the Martian Sphinx. Anyway, a trial was dispensed with and Nathan Hale was hanged the next day. The fun never stops, does it? This ejaculation of outrage by General Howe and his troops dropped Nathan Hale directly into American history books, but it isn't quite true that Hale had but one life to lose for his country. Actually, he had as many as there are alternate realities, in some of which, for instance, he could have just opened up a hot dog stand or something, if they had hot dogs back then. In the universe under consideration here, no source states whether any mandrake roots grew at the scene of his death, and it's probably better not to know. In any event, it isn't hard to see why Mandragora liked Goblin Hood's story, nor why, as it later turned out, all of the Black Widows liked it so much that they threw a big, long, dissipated orgy centering around their weird hierophant, an orgy in which everyone wore bright orange psionic t-shirts in honor of the Gob's dream. This was certainly a pleasanter way to pass the time than by trying to wax diplomatic while being jerked around by the best detective in town. Meanwhile, back at the Shogun's Squirrel, while G.H. was off dicking around with his myriad lovers, leaving nobody responsible to babysit the fluffy-tailed little walking disaster area, the Gob's duly appointed head of the investigation was taking this opportunity to screw up royally elsewhere. What song the sirens sang, or what name Achilles assumed when he hid himself among women, although puzzling questions, are not beyond all conjecture. Sir Thomas Brown, urn burial. When Edgar Allan Poe included the above quote in his seminal detective masterpiece, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, he obviously couldn't have had anyone like the Shogun Squirrel in mind. Though the famous Odysseus outwitted the sirens and even detected Achilles among the women, the Shogun Squirrel didn't have time for that wise guy stuff employed by tricksters like Odysseus, and clearly favored brawn over brains. The more brainless the brawn, in fact, the better. What had begun so admirably with the engaging Monsieur C. Auguste Dupin and his exquisite exercises in ratiocination had continued honorably with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's venerable consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, despite a little playful sniping at his illustrious predecessor. By the 1930s and 40s, the process of detection had become somewhat coarsened, just in time for the hard-boiled adventures of the likes of Dashiell Hammett, Sam Spade, and Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe. Before long, alas, the process had degenerated to the two-fisted and misogynistic antics of Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer. At some point during the late decadence of Poe's analytic detective genre, the Shogun Squirrel came blundering and lurping along. Unfortunately, the squirrel's basic outlook and attitudes, including its asinine display of machismo and bravado, let alone its obnoxious braggadocio, had been principally inspired by the brutal and tugboat-faced but best-selling Spillane. Following the departure of its peers from the presumed crime scene, the Shogun Squirrel had remained farting around there for a while, ostensibly looking for clues, but it had soon given up in disgust when whatever evidence there might have been declined to walk right up to it and bend over, soft underbelly exposed. The police were at fault, as Poe would have put it. Actually, what police there were off at the palace with a do not disturb forever sign on the door, getting thousands of rim jobs from their devoted sex slave, the cult leader of for a world. The mayor and the elephant triad had vanished to God knows where, probably to wherever all sensible citizens of Sodom buggered off to whenever the Black Widows were unavailable to keep the peace, especially when the protective gaze of harmlessness was going to hell in a handbasket, and most especially when the best detective in town was on the prod. Clearly, this case would be a tough nut to crack, and nobody was more nuts about cracking nuts than the crackpot head of the investigation. It followed, then, that if anybody was going to crack this case, that anybody was going to have to be the Shogun Squirrel.
"When the going gets tough, the tough get going," repeated the animal tersely to itself. Then it got going. But first a little liquid refreshment. On its way to the Golden Tarantula, the squirrel stopped off at the palace to once again offer Goblinhood a piece of the action. When it couldn't get in, the squirrel blew up and began shrieking things like,
"Oh, so that's the way you want to play it, eh?"
Actually, this was the way the squirrel liked it, which it realized once its snit was over. This way it would get all the glory and wouldn't have to risk bursting into tears again.
"When the going gets tough, the tough get gruff,"
it thought gruffly, noticing absently the letters SSS spray painted lavishly on one of the palace walls. But it began to notice those letters smeared around all over the place as it wended its way along. Dimly, it wondered if this could be a clue. Back at the bar, the squirrel sat around drinking Golden Tarantulas with the now totally paranoid Pinkovsky, occasionally twitching the Russian's frayed nerves regarding the government's growing suspicions about the Singularity Pioneer, though the squirrel had tried earlier to alibi Pinkovsky, it still wasn't above indulging in a little schadenfreude here. Then Pinkovsky got some of his own back.
Do you have any idea what the SSS spray painted all over town means?
Inquired the only half-interested squirrel. I'm not sure, smirked the Russian. It either means soaking squirrels suck, or soaking shithead squirrel. Different people say different things. All of the squirrel's fur stood erect. This might be the most important clue of all. After beating the living shit out of Pinkovsky for daring to utter such words, the Shogun squirrel stalked around Outsidersville, following up increasingly harebrained leads. This half-assed investigation was now complicated by the squirrel's urgent need to discover who was pasquinading it so disrespectfully with the spray-painted initials. Actually, the obscure graffiti didn't have anything to do with the Shogun squirrel, or with anything else germane, for that matter. The squirrel's simplistic modus operandi consisted of beating the living shit out of anyone who got in his way and demanding to know who was responsible for that terrible writing on the wall, not to mention who was committing murder by impalement. The squirrel was able to do this, in part, by virtue of the fact that Goblinhood and the Black Widows were all otherwise engaged. Perhaps worst of all, the squirrel had the unmitigated gall to add insult to the many injuries that it ventured upon by loudly proclaiming things like,
"Goblin had told me to do this."
Sadly, whatever physical or circumstantial murder evidence might have actually been out there was most likely buried in the shards and rubble created by the Shogun squirrel's violent humdinger of a tirade. Among the things irretrievably lost was the secret of what the SSS graffiti actually meant. Nobody ever solved the mystery either of how enough time had elapsed between the crime scene and the indisposed visit to the Gob's palace for his newspaper story to get published so they could have that orgy. Perhaps the squirrel's time sense was more fucked up than the Gob had suspected. In short, however, it would certainly be something of an understatement to say that the miniature detective wound up blowing the murder investigation. Indeed, left to its own devices, the volatile rodent meddled so dick-headedly with important matters and generated so much pointless chaos of its own that in the end nothing less could ensue than the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. The end. But across the hinge, Mandragora came into the Gob's library before he could start wallowing in self-pity and depressing alternate history science fiction, and announced that Pinkovsky would be showing up pretty soon. What the hell's he going to want? Goblinhood wanted to know. I think he's going to want to hire you, or somehow persuade you to track the real singularity killer down so that people won't suspect him instead. How the devil did he find out about this? I thought it was supposed to be a secret. Oh, word gets around, you know. Probably the Shogun squirrel. you think Pankowski did it? Not really. Actually, I have my own theory, which involves that Martian you used to hang out with. Goblinhood didn't feel like going into the Nurgle situation just then, and said instead, "You know what Gene Barry said in the film War of the Worlds?" "No, what did he say?" "He yammered that with the energy from just one square dance, we could send those Martians back where they came from," or words to that effect. Sounds pretty square. Well, it was the 50s. Then later, during the late 80s, the Fox Network created a short-lived TV series based on that movie. Only in that series, it developed that the aliens didn't come from Mars after all. They came from a planet much farther away called Mortax or something. Mortax? Yeah, Goblinhood laughed. George Bush had just been elected president by promising not to raise taxes, so maybe it had something to do with that. But I thought he did raise taxes. Yeah, he did, later. And then later, still, his administration was toppled by a performance artist come exorcist from Columbus, Ohio, for raising taxes and for throwing up all over the Japanese prime minister or something during a trade mission. I swear, he looked just like Linda Blair in the TV footage. They were both laughing now. Besides, there was this Geraldo Rivera special on the tube during the election, which made it sound to me as if there might be a Satanist for Bush conspiracy going on. Was there a Satanist for Bush conspiracy? Nah, actually that was me too. During the 88 election, I was going to go hang around the polls with my suitcase doll, wearing a Satanist for Bush button, to confuse the voters. But then I gave it up, because I thought it would be dirty politics. Dirty politics? But I thought Bush was the one who got accused of racist tactics with that Willie Horton revolving prison door campaign ad against his opponent. That was pretty dirty. Yeah, but how do you know so much about my original continuum? Oh, I know lots of things, she replied mysteriously. Actually, she was just reading his mind, accessing his own memories. But she couldn't tell him that, or there would have been no point in having a conversation. And she'd been delegated by her peers to cheer him up after the earlier harrowing episode concerning the supposed impalement murder. One thing I don't know, she continued, was about that business with broccoli. What was that about? Actually, she did know, but she wanted him to tell it, to keep his mind off more depressing matters, because she also knew about his growing suicidal tendencies. After Bush was elected, he went on TV and proclaimed that the White House wouldn't be serving broccoli anymore. He'd had to eat it as a kid, and he didn't like it. But I liked it. It was the only vegetable that I did like. And Bush was guilty of hubris, playing power politics with a helpless vegetable. Anyway, at the exorcism, we had a whole case of broccoli that we were passing out to people. We even offered some to the cops when they showed up, and I'm convinced that the broccoli did the trick. Why was it hubris? Well, the Ameriflora fiasco, as ill-conceived as it was supposed to be a celebration of plant life. And Bush, who had made a martyr out of broccoli, had the unmitigated gall to show up there and make a speech. How could Saint Broccoli take that lying down? Was Bush at the exorcism? Well, I sent him a long letter inviting him, but he probably thought I was just a crackpot. Besides, he was there in the morning, and I scheduled the exorcism for 6 p.m. so that working people could attend it. Besides, snickered the gop, the exorcism was supposed to drive out evil spirits, meaning him, so I wanted to be sure that he'd already be gone when we did it. So no, he wasn't there, but it worked anyway. Did the cops cause any trouble? Nah, there were only 20 or 30 of us outside the main gate, and the management sent 3 cops over to keep an eye on us and make sure we didn't create any real problems, sort of like the Nut Squad or something. Mostly the Ameriflora people wanted to pretend we weren't around. The cops just kidded around with us. They asked me if I'd ever done any exorcisms before, and I said that I had. I was a trained professional. This was sort of true. In 1974, after a trip to Washington with a friend, Goblinhood's creator had a rotten tooth extracted, which supposedly, psionically, toppled the corrupt Nixon administration. On that same tooth day, Nixon resigned. How exactly did you accomplish the Bush exorcism? Inquired Mandragora. I had a small painting with me of me and Suitcase hanging out with Saint Broccoli. Taped on the back of it was a cartoon of Bush throwing up. It was from this Bush puke I'd been selling at a local gallery after the Japanese debacle. Anyway, I just drew my Martian harmlessness sigil on the caricature with crayons, and that was it. That and the spiritual force of the other people there, not to mention the power of Saint Broccoli. You know, the exorcism seemed pretty half-assed and small time to most people. The regular media, for instance, didn't cover it at all. But there was actually a real Democratic candidate for Congress attending the exorcism. And later he had the exorcism televised for the folks at home on public access. We had lots of video cameras there, which might be why the cops didn't bother us. Betty lost his election, too. Uh-huh. Speaking of couch potatoes, the folks at home, weren't there supposed to be tubers involved in that whole mess somehow? Something about potatoes? Oh no, that was just Bush's vice president, Dan Quayle. He was a real clown and a buffoon. The media pasquinaded him on a regular basis. One time he was at some school pretending that the Bush administration supported education when actually all it supported was rich people. Anyway, it turned out that Quayle couldn't spell potato. He spelled it potato. Some school kid had to correct him. They were both laughing again now. Potato makes athlete's foot sound like a potato blight, mused Mandragora facetiously. Yeah, Quayle always came off sounding like an idiot. One time, a newspaper quoted him talking about the space program. Quayle apparently still thought there were canals on Mars, which meant there was water, which meant there was air, which meant we can breathe there. He should have gone there and tried it, the jerk. Suddenly reminded, Mandragora asked, what about the War of the Worlds? Huh? The Fox series. Was it any good? She was trying to steer the conversation back to Mars and to her theory. Not very. They did one interesting show, I seem to remember, about the Orson Welles radio broadcast of the Welles story. But the series itself couldn't hold a candle to the old Marvel comics Killraven series, especially after Don McGregor took over the writing and Craig Russell took over the art. This was another pastiche concerning the Wells story about a return invasion immune to Earth germs and a futuristic freedom fighter under Martian occupation. The series had originally been dreamed up by Roy Thomas and only ran for a couple of years before it was canceled in 1976. Though later, circa 1983, the story had been concluded with an impressive graphic novel. For all its faults, Goblin Hood had long considered this to be one of the best overground comic book sequences of all time. He'd eventually owned the entire series, and he now had a psionic duplicate of it in his library. So they sat there yapping about comic books until Goblin Hood suddenly remembered about Oleg's prophesied visit. "I thought Pinkovsky was going to show up," he pouted. "He's been dawdling along the way. He's sort of afraid to come here, but I sense that he will be here in a few minutes. You know, I've been wondering something lately." "I know. You're wondering why my precog talent doesn't tell us important things, such as that this impalement murder or whatever it was going to take place. First of all, it's not an exact science. I get impressions that random, sort of the way you forget things you're about to say, more or less at random. And I think some of my previsions involve alternate worlds, alternate futures. Then, too, my hunches are usually pretty vague and short range, and I don't think they work at all where singularities are involved. It's all a lot more difficult than it sounds." "Oh, say, if you can read my mind, then how come you don't tell me those things that I was just about to say whenever that happens?" "What? And blow your rush of aphasia addiction? Besides, I read the aphasia too, and its effect always extends to me too." "Well, that makes sense, I guess." Tactfully, Mandragora omitted any comment on how stupid those unsaid things would probably turn out to be, since this would beg the question of whether he ever said anything that didn't sound stupid. She'd learned that tact could be an important factor where both telepathy and precognition were concerned. Mandragora split after Pinkovsky showed up, although she stayed in an adjacent room to monitor the former Soviet's thoughts, which were turbulent and confused, as well as being conceived mostly in Russian. G.H. tried to explain something to his visitor. "Look, I'm no detective. You ought to be talking to the Shogun Squirrel about the singularity killer. The Shogun Squirrel could probably follow its nose to the killer, if there is one, though that might not be true much longer if the little douchebag keeps on smoking cigars and hash and stuff." "The squirrel can stick a cigar up its ass," growled Oleg petulantly. He no longer liked the officious rodent, and probably didn't trust it not to start testicle thumping or whatever at some crucial moment. "But there's something else I want you to do for me, Goblin Hood." "Now what?" thought the gob, though being able to form a pretty good guess even without precognition, he remained silent. "Tell your American government," continued Pinkovsky, "that if they won't act upon my important message about the Soviet nuclear attack, then I'll be forced to use psionics to transform myself into a gigantic star. Then I'll psionically convert a bunch of trees and all into hydrogen and convert that into other elements, resulting in nova conditions, and then, whatever the rest of it is. Right, said the god. Tell me, Oleg, have you ever considered seeking professional help? Unfortunately, there wasn't any professional help around. For some reason, Sodom didn't attract anybody with a shrink mentality, unless you wanted to count all the amateurs running around psychoanalyzing each other. But Mandragora came in just then to try and help talk Pinkovsky back down to some sort of quasi-terrestrial mindset. Sadly, though, these circumstances, if only by wasting everybody's time and energy, tended to contribute inexorably to the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. The end. But across the hinge, G.H. fell asleep cleaning his rod after reading about half of Niven's All the Myriad Ways story. He awoke with the pistol lying on his desk, pointing at him, and the Shogun squirrel brutally slapping him around and snarling things like,
"Get a grip on yourself, G.H. That isn't the way. Only cowards resort to suicide. When the going gets tough, the tough have to just tough it out."
Blearily holding the furry little blackguard off at a safe distance, the gob sleepily considered twisting the rodent's tough little head off and blaming it on being so rudely awakened. But he sensed that such an action might just be the straw that broke the camel's back and brought about the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. Instead, he growled, "What the fuck do you want now? And for that matter, how the fuck did you get in here?"
"Bah! It was a mere snap for the best detective in town," snapped the squirrel, snapping its oddly humanoid fingers in Goblin Hood's face until the gob thought that his mind really would snap. "Actually," explained Mandragora, entering quietly, "I let the little cretin sneak in here just to see what would happen. Precognitively speaking, things were going so badly across the various hinges that I thought it was time to start grasping at straws. By the way," she continued, "you asked me in an alternate time track, which I perceived as a possible future, why I didn't predict serious things precognitively."
"I did?" gaped the gob.
"Yeah, but it occurs to me this time around to ask you the same thing. Why don't you predict how this will all turn out by using your tarot cards, or by calling on the Martian Tarot to help?
It's not an exact science, and the Martian Tarot couldn't help much anyway, because it's just something that I made up and painted on the back of a jacket," muttered the gob. "Besides, the future sort of scares me."
"I know, and I know what you mean,"
she nodded.
"What the Sam Hill are you damned psychic freaks wandering about?"
demanded the Shogun squirrel, irritated by all this ESP lingo.
"Don't you know that there's a mystery adventure going on?"
"In terms of sentience, the Shogun squirrel is an extremely young entity," reflected goblinhood privately, and also an extremely rambunctious one, not to mention bellicose, thought Mandragora to GH, also on the QT. Aloud, he asked her, "Do you see anything ahead of us to indicate who this postulated killer might turn out to be?" "No," she admitted. "Everything pertaining to it is veiled in a weird shroud of occlusion. I'm only seeing previews of screen memories, it looks like. Perhaps that blind spot effect is part of the singularity's anti-psionic field itself," speculated Goblinhood. "Tell me," rejoined his psionic paramour, "what did the cards have to say the last time you did consult them?" "I'm not quite sure," G.H. temporized, "but as near as I could figure it, they seemed to be predicting the destruction of the entire alternate reality continuum. This universe here, that is." They both stared at him in a sort of ejaculatory silence. "But I could be wrong," he added, kind of lamely. The Shogun squirrel bounced back first.
"Well, never mind about all that,"
muttered the small animal in a grizzled, hard-boiled tone of voice.
"We have an important murder mystery to solve, and I've sniffed out another important clue."
"Do tell," murmured the gop, rolling his eyes as Mandragora smirked behind the golden tarantula mask which she'd been wearing for a while now, and quite becomingly, too. "What did you smell, SS?" she asked. "What did you smell, SS?" chimed in Goblinhood.
"Water,"
replied the Shogun squirrel. "Water," they both repeated, dumbfounded.
"But this was no ordinary water,"
the nosy little detective hastened to explain.
"This water was different."
"Different how?" questioned the gob. "How different?" demanded Mandra.
"It just wasn't ordinary,"
elaborated the squirrel, not very articulately, sort of wishing that this piece of evidence had simply walked up and bent over, soft underbelly exposed. Then, noticing their exchange of significant glances, the little bugger snapped,
"It's not an exact science, anyway, you know?"
Nobody could dispute that. 9 more unsolved impalement murders later, the Shogun squirrel was still smiling, was still smelling this stuff. It seemed, in fact, to have water on the brain. They were in the heterosexual quarter this time, Breeder Town, as it was known to some of its neighbors. The latest victim was a woman, a mother of two. Had things been working properly, this part of town should have been more harmless than anywhere else, because of all the children around. According to the geese, they were supposed to be sheltered from harm or corruption until, subjectively in each case, their age of innocence ended naturally. However, things hadn't been working properly lately anywhere in Sodom, and it was getting progressively worse and worse all the time. The first victim had been a painter named Delmore Squidge, as it turned out. The only thing linking him to this woman, Amelia Erwig, was the red hourglass tattoo, which identified them both as particularly fanatical St. Claudians or followers of Maya. In fact, all of the victims so far had been such St. Claudian zealots. The tattoos denoted an inner circle within the outer cult. The wearers were as devout as anyone but a black widow or the Gob himself could be. This was beginning to look a whole hell of a lot like the work of a serial killer with religious motives.
T.H., you know my methods,
drawled the squirrel, lighting up a big fucking curved pipe. Yeah, sure, what now? Groaned the weary Gob. Mandragora, looking on, foresaw the squirrel's big moment of dramatic revelation, but chose not to spoil it.
This time, yapped the Shogun squirrel, its pipe chirping, I not only smell the extraordinary water, this time,
it paused for effect, and then pounced on a cardboard box discarded outside the singularity.
I've tracked the smell to its very source.
Apparently, the source was located within that cardboard box.
Hold everything,
exclaimed Mandragora, unable to restrain herself further, lurching impulsively forward and unceremoniously scraping the yelping squirrel off of its momentarily triumphant perch.
I recognize this.
Interested, Goblin had walked out of the singularity, which was located in a large vacant lot this time. From outside, and it and its contents looked like part of the trash-strewn expanse. A cold wind was blowing as he examined the squirrel's prize. Small, dapple gray-green, shallow, squarish box contained a silk-lined holding area. This held two brass mounts for candles. A space in the middle might have held a crucifix at one time. There were also four small empty bottles. Two of them were labeled holy water. The others had traces of some kind of oil.
This is like a Catholic sick room kit or something,
explained the Black Widow excitedly.
A friend of mine used to have one of these. Look, there's even an instruction folder inside. The squirrel must have been smelling this holy water for as long as it lasted. I'm sure only a squirrel's keen little nostrils could detect the difference.
Actually, there was no difference, except that this water had been blessed by a Catholic priest or something. Perhaps the squirrel had smelled the water in some sort of conjunction with whatever the oil was. Some sick room, muttered the Gob, staring at the carnage within the singularity.
You mean the murderer was blessing the victims with holy water?
Demanded the squirrel.
I'm not really sure, admitted Mandragora. In any case, the holy water seems to have run out.
Turning the collar of his trench coat up against the wind, Goblin had got the feeling that time was also running out. But right now it was time for the meat wagon again. About a week later, Joan, the so-called elephant woman, found herself walking home alone, late at night, from a big party at Club Mastodon. This was sort of unusual, in that she was normally inseparable from John and Jack, her triumvirate cohorts. It was also unusual that she loitered and dawdled senselessly while passing an abandoned warehouse along a dimly lit and deserted street.
She made a big point of brandishing the bright red hourglass tattoo newly emblazoned on her bicep. And it worked. A dark shape sprang out at her from a dark alley. It was a man carrying a long, sharp wooden stake. Suddenly, the man was transfixed by a convergence of bright floodlights. The terrifyingly amplified voice of the Shogun Squirrel commanded,
"Put down your weapon and raise your hands. We have you surrounded."
And the trap was sprung. The plan had been simple. So simple-minded, in fact, that everyone involved, even Barbarossa, had collaborated in attributing it to the Shogun Squirrel. The little rascal never once suspected the degree to which it was being humored by its amused colleagues. The fact was that the vain but stumped rodent detective had grandiosely vowed to eat its own weight in deadly fugu liver if it did not crack this case, though nobody really worried about that except for a few delicious but poisonous Japanese blowfish. Joan, who had long since casually joined the outer Maya cult with her two comrades, though all pointedly refused to wear masks, had now publicly joined the Hourglass faction. Even being tattooed in public, it had made the spiderwebs front page headlines. All week, in fact, and none too subtly. Then she'd spent every night traipsing this sleazy warehouse district on her way home alone from highly publicized social events, supposedly unaccompanied by her elephant peers, according to the gossip columns, because they were pissed at her for not inviting them to join the inner cult with her. Anyway, the posse, made up of elephant people, dwarves, hourglass cultists, black widows, goblinhood, and the Shogun Squirrel, had been all along lying in wait for her prospective attacker, hidden behind various psionic contrivances of their own. And now here he was, struggling with superhuman strength to escape the grasp of several black widows, and wearing a plain black mask with a silver cross on the forehead. With firm but grim determination, the exalted squirrel strutted forward, climbed to the prisoner's shoulder, and, with a grand flourish, very belligerently yanked off the prisoner's mask. "Well, I'll be damned," breathed Goblinhood. "It's Vlad Tsepes himself, better known to history as Vlad the Impaler, or even as Dracula." And so it was, though Goblinhood apparently didn't realize that Tsepes, pronounced Tsepes, also meant the Impaler. Vlad's Turkish enemies, meanwhile, called him Kazıklı Bey, which also meant the Impaler. It was a very popular sobriquet.
"You will be damned, warlock," snarled the medieval prince,
his own psionic singularity field guaranteeing that his words, which would normally have been psionically translated, remained just so much antique Romanian gibberish to his auditors, though his field seemed to let their words be translated well enough for him. In fact, this obstructive effect began slowly dissipating at once, probably due to the proximity of so many other psionic fields working in concert. Still, the translation problem was at first immense. Hence, the questioning of Vlad was long and confusing, even to the telepathic Black Widows, who for a long time could sense his thoughts without fully understanding them. Fortunately, Goblinhood was apparently familiar with the Impaler, having, for one thing, recognized him from old portraits and woodcuts. Goblinhood had collected a lot of data on Vlad years ago for what the Gob called his atrocity files, pictures, articles, clippings, etc., to be used as examples of something in his work. This made him the local authority on Vlad, and so he wound up in charge of the psionic translation, though he was mostly left to fill in the blanks of that Vlad's story for the others while they waited for the Impaler's anti-psionic field, or whatever it was, to finish breaking down. Cutting to the chase, the story went like this. Vlad was a quasi-Transylvanian Voivod or warlord who ruled in Wallachia during the latter half of the 15th century. A German tale has him taking office in 1457 or 56. His father was called Vlad Dracul, also called the Devil, and had been invested with the Order of the Dragon by some bigwig. This was basically an appointment to fight the Turks during an interminable religious war. Vlad Tepes inherited this mandate and was called Dracula, or Son of the Devil. Vlad became famous for his draconian methods. He also somehow became the basis for the most notorious fictional vampire of all time, Dracula, immortalized by Bram Stoker. It's important, perhaps, to remember that most of Vlad's negative image was contributed to history by his enemies. Turks, Germans, Jews, Gypsies, fellow Wallachians, and practically everybody else. Some people, though, have since characterized or romanticized Vlad as an heroic nationalist whose extreme measures saved his country from being overrun and tyrannized by anybody but him, that is. Evidently, too, he had some loyal followers at the time, because he was removed from, but then returned to, power at least once in a career as checkered as head cheese. One story suggests, though, that he was killed in battle by his own troops, perhaps an early example of fragging, though it may have been an accident. Supposedly, in any case, his head wound up publicly adorning a stake in Turkish Constantinople, but of course that must have been a case like Hitler's double in order for Vlad to be here now, unless stronger magic than time-dimensional travel was involved. Vlad had lived in a time of bloodthirsty religious conflict. At one point, he'd escaped long imprisonment by converting from the Greek Orthodox brand of Christianity to Roman Catholicism, and then marrying his captor's daughter. To a lot of people at the time, this conversion was supposedly more unforgivable than the cruel despot's innumerable atrocities. But most of what is known about Vlad concerns his most characteristic antics. as a power-mad and paranoid dictator, burning his enemies, boiling his enemies, roasting his enemies, and then force-feeding them to their friends, torturing and mutilating his enemies, eating dinner surrounded by the corpses of his enemies, and above all, to the tune of several thousand times, impaling his enemies, usually via the rectum, using a round-tipped, oiled stake. This was to prolong the death agonies. It was said to kill by displacing the internal organs, and could last for as long as a week. When the impaler wanted to show mercy, however, or as in the present case, when time was short, a sharpened stake was used. Vlad seemed to be aware of the sexual implications of this favorite punishment of his. After one battle, he impaled all of his soldiers who'd been wounded in the back, running away, that is, and informed them that they deserved it because they weren't men. He sometimes impaled people in even more imaginative or overtly sexual ways, particularly women, whom he seems to have hated. He once sliced his mistress open to prove to her that he hadn't gotten her pregnant. Another woman, a housewife, was impaled for not mending her husband's shirt. Oddly, all the old woodcuts depicting Vlad at dinner surrounded by his victims show people impaled in every conceivable fashion but the ones which he's usually said to have used, as if even the propagandists of the time had trouble facing the true pathological ugliness of what Vlad was doing. In any case, Stoker's Dracula was a relatively civilized gent compared to the public image of Vlad himself, whom history had managed to treat worse than Griswold treated Poe. And yet, somehow, here the fucking prick was, clearly at it again. As translation became easier, this mystery became a little bit less enigmatic, at least if one took Vlad's word for things. Most sources, regardless of the controversial conversion from one form of Christianity to another, had firmly cast Vlad in the role of a militantly Christian warrior prince, a sort of crusader. Now Vlad was saying, as best goblinhood could gradually make out, that the Christian God had forgiven his tyrannical sins and all committed for the cause, and had resurrected him as a soldier of the Lord, the merest vanguard of an overwhelming force that was supposedly coming to wipe goblinhood's bunch out. The very fact of Vlad's capture in the Shogun Squirrel's absurd sting operation, of course, plus the lack of any visible evidence to support the idea of some overwhelming invasion force, tended to argue that Vlad was simply one more delusional crackpot, no doubt kicked out of his original continuum and time period, now running around Sodom, indulging his vicious proclivities through the use of his so-called Christian magic of psionics, with, of course, a little help from Pinkovsky's invention and development of the singularity field. And just as Vlad had done historically, he was now justifying his sickening activities through religious considerations, engaging in his own private little jihad in the name of a Christian army which probably only existed in his warped imagination. Information regarding this so-called overwhelming force was minimal, introduced in the first place only as a kind of self-protective threat. But the gob eventually got an earful on other subjects from the rabid Vovod, who seemed to regard St. Cloudianity as the ultimate blasphemy. Vlad had struck at the highest group in cult hierarchy that was still, unlike the telepathic Black Widows, who could sense the danger if not understand it, vulnerable to a surprise attack by one whose strength was greatly enhanced either by religious psionic means or simply by that legendary adrenaline fix attributed to the violently insane. Meanwhile, his own Christian spells, or whatever they were, had masked him somehow from telepathic discovery until now.
"Wait a minute,"
interrupted the confused Shogun Squirrel at this point.
"I thought Dracula was afraid of Bibles and crosses and stuff. So if this guy's Dracula, how can he use Christian magic spells?"
"Like I said," explained the gob patiently, "he supposedly cut some kind of a deal with the Christian god, probably long ago. Besides all that vampire stuff, crosses and garlic and mirrors and whatever, was mostly just superstition as far as I know. Some of it may have previously existed as peasant belief systems and been integrated into the Dracula story by Bram Stoker. For example, look at the way Vlad's chief emblem, the wooden stake, got cleaned up for Victorian sensibilities and sublimated into the legend."
"Cleaned up is right," laughed Mandragora, sort of callously, perhaps, under the circumstances. "It's as if everyone, but Stoker in particular, had wiped the ass of Vlad's true reputation."
"Bitch!" thundered the Impaler. "Vile harlot! Whore of hell! If only I could see you twitching and squirming on the end of my stake. Thrust up your stinking, corrupt bowels."
At least they were getting beyond the communication difficulties. Goblinhood made one last try at fishing for information about that upcoming overwhelming force, but it was no go. So he gave up, figuring to wait for the next wave of impalement murders or whatever, if he had to. Shrugging, he started to walk away.
"Wait a minute,"
snapped the now fairly coherent murderer, his fierce mustache bristling.
"What about me?"
"That's right,"
yapped the Shogun Squirrel, snapping its tiny fingers for emphasis.
"Don't we put this guy in jail or something?"
Goblinhood blinked. "Well, we'll be on guard against him, of course, so he can't murder anybody else. But no, I don't feel like putting him in some kind of jail and feeding him in jail and all."
"Neither do we,"
seconded Joan, speaking for the entire elephant triad and shrugging. Barbarossa shrugged too.
"You know, there aren't actually any laws around here apart from magic ones.
And none of us are exactly democratically elected officials," commented Mandragora judiciously.
"So it's really not our problem,"
theorized the Shogun Squirrel, slowly catching on.
"You mean I'm free to go?"
demanded the Impaler, who couldn't believe his ears. "Go to hell," responded Goblinhood flatly. "But leave the stake here, instructed Mandragora.
You haven't heard the last of me,
snarled Vlad Sepish, scampering happily away.
Shove it up your ass,
sneered the Shogun Squirrel, sticking its hands in its pockets. Do you folks want to watch? Goblin Hood asked the other dignitaries, tiredly lighting a cigarette.
No, sighed Joan, but it's probably our responsibility.
So they all meandered in the direction Vlad had gone. Vlad's enemies caught up with him a couple of blocks away. Some had been in the squirrel's posse. Others had heard the news from some telepathic black widow and come running. All had cared about one or more of the 10 murder victims. At least one of them was a highly skilled psionic technician who transformed the hapless Vlad into a being with 10 assholes, 10 rectal organs. They impaled him then on 10 sharpened stakes, one at a time. Vlad screamed shrilly 10 times, and then simply screamed continuously until he died of shock and blood loss. In its way, the end was merciful. Goblin Hood and company stood staring stonily at this final impalement as the bloodthirsty mob dispersed.
Could we have stopped them?
Wondered Joan sadly.
Should we have?
Countered Mandragora resignedly. I don't know, answered the gob to both questions impassively. The big problem is that they were able to do this at all, and without creating any kind of singularity field that I could detect, it means that the harmlessness gauge is finally going the way of the ozone layer back where I came from.
It's all existential,
pronounced the Shogun Squirrel profoundly. They all looked at the squirrel, who was trying to sound like Philip Marlowe at the end of Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep.
You know, like Camus wrote about,
continued the little animal uncertainly, trying to come off sounding learned and philosophical, but totally blowing the effect by making Camus rhyme with Amos.
Oh, to hell with it,
grumbled the best detective in town, giving up with a shrug. They all seconded that. Much later that night, Goblin Hood and Mandragora were making love in his bed. He had his tongue thrust up her luscious brown asshole while she sprawled above him, screwing his own asshole with a well-greased dildo and sucking his cock. Typically, Goblin Hood was hoping to get invited to buttfuck the precognitive Black Widow, who alone knew whether that would happen or not. In many ways, she, of course, was essentially just like all the other widows, but her asshole was all her own and was gaping moistly open at this moment. His blood burned for her. But a knock on the door shattered the moment. Mandra's lovely sphincter slammed shut in the gob's face.
God damn it, he muttered.
I'll get it,
she exclaimed, playfully bounding up and leaving the plastic dildo buried in his ass. But she was blushing as she went through his living room, embarrassed at having been too sexually distracted to foresee this visitation. It might be important. The thoughts she was picking up from outside his front door were panic-stricken and urgent, but largely incoherent. They were also oddly familiar and totally strange at the same time. In any case, her telepathic faculty wasn't at its best, she being pretty well wasted and still a little distracted by her still twitching anus. But it was only the Shogun squirrel out there, or rather a Shogun frog, wearing a well-tailored little trench coat and matching fedora, trying to brandish a bottle of champagne in its flabby forepaws. "What happened to you?" asked Mandragora, amazed.
"Never mind,"
croaked the small amphibian.
"I need your help. Can I come in?"
By the time G.H. was dressed in his usual grubby black jeans and t-shirt and disposed to receive guests, the Black Widow had psionically changed the frog back into a squirrel at its urgent behest. "How did you get up here past the guards?" demanded Goblin Hood grouchily.
"Yeah, and where are all the other Black Widows?" asked his companion, still minus her usual G-string, but evidently unconcerned in front of the squirrel.
"They're all attending a big Star Trek festival in the castle's main ballroom," explained the Shogun squirrel, immensely pleased to be a rodent again for whatever reason. "But I think Star Trek is for idiots," it continued, not very diplomatically. "I got bored and started making fun of the show they were watching, and they said I was pestering them, and one of them changed me into a frog."
Nor, obviously, had the rodent's feeble psionic capability been up to effecting the change back. It was going to go on and paint an epic picture of its torturous journey from there to here with its champagne, but it was rudely interrupted.
"The Star Trek Festival,"
squealed Mandragora, whirling upon Goblin Hood, her buttocks quivering.
"I forgot all about it. Every episode or film ever made on the subject, including variations from alternate universes, and I'm missing it just to wet nurse you."
"Gee whiz," gleeped the gob. "Don't blame me. It wasn't my idea to have a bodyguard. Besides, we could still go attend it if you want to."
"Not if the squirrel has already been kicked out," grumbled the essentially kind-hearted Black Widow, slowly regaining her composure and aware of her duties as hostess. Besides, she could always attend in spirit through telepathic contact with her peers. But right now, her telepathy told her that the Shogun squirrel had no place else to go, having already bored Pinkovsky silly, bragging about its detective exploits at the Golden Tarantula and not really having any other friends. It vaguely surprised her that the other widows had let the obnoxious little pest hang out with them in the first place, though she knew the squirrel could be sort of amusing. In some ways, Mandra had lost touch with her sisters while protectively squiring Goblinhood around. She'd been picked for the job because of her quirky precognitive talent, unique among the telepathic sisterhood, though she seldom used the talent lately since it wasn't working any too well, whatever the psychic occlusion was that she'd earlier described to Goblet Hood, had actually intensified rather than abated after the capture and execution of Vlad. It was a little like having a head cold, except that instead of having trouble breathing, she was having trouble seeing the future, even as a spread of alternate possibilities. Every time she tried it, just lately, it made her senses swim and gave her the beginnings of a splitting headache. As for the other widows, she'd seen some of them at the big fracas centering around the impaler. But in the excitement, they'd forgotten to remind her of the Star Trek festival which they'd all been planning.